Ashley Gilbertson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Well, you are an internationally known photographer, and I wanted to just start by asking you why you came to photography or how you came to photography. Is this something that you came across as a child or something that came a little bit later in life? What is it about photography that really speaks to you as a medium of art and of expression and of telling a story?
I started shooting when I was 13, and I, like any 13-year-old, I was a self-obsessed teenager, and I wanted pictures of myself skateboarding. So I bought I begged my dad and my mom for a camera, and they bought me a little camera, and I realized immediately that I couldn't take pictures of myself doing tricks. So I started photographing my friends, who happened to be really good, and it was about a year later that I published my first picture in a skateboarding magazine. And that feeling of seeing something happen, take a photograph of it, and then see it in a magazine and show thousands of people, you know, this thing that you had seen was – I mean, it was totally addictive. It was like, it's magical, you know, to be the messenger, you know, like, don't shoot me, haha, but like, it's the best thing. It was absolutely satisfying. And it gave me permission from then on, once I was this sort of accredited photographer, to go into spaces that I wouldn't otherwise be allowed to go into. And in a skateboarding sense, that might have been parks, it might have been people that I hung out with that were much, much better than, you know, I could ever be. But then in a broader sense, you know, in the photographic world that I now sort of inhabit, I get to be on the sidelines of history and watch all of these things that are taking place that, you know, ordinarily you would be reading about, hearing about in the radio. And I get to see with my eyes, try to interpret that and then show people the sort of, you know, truthful manner, these things that I'm learning and witnessing. And that's, you know, gives me a huge sense of purpose, but it's also amazingly cool.
Can you tell when you're looking at something or when you're kind of thinking about something that, oh, this is going to be an awesome shot? Or does that kind of come later when you're looking at the film?
Almost all of the work that I do now is part of a larger story. So quite often, yeah, you'll come across a scenario which is very compelling and you think that there's going to be a great picture here and you work as hard as you can to make the best picture you can. But I think the pictures really come to life when they're part of a narrative and part of a larger picture or series of photographs, you know, online or in the newspaper, further on down the track. And what will often happen is you actually have to lose, you know, the strongest picture in order to create a stronger narrative, because a strong picture will take so much attention away from the other photographs that you need to balance it out a little bit. But there are certainly moments when everything comes together, when all the elements are, you know, in one frame. I remember in Iraq, I've been working there for years, and the Marines had captured an insurgent. They had shot and captured him. He was wounded, and they were waiting for him to be evacuated. And they covered his head with a sweater, and a Marine was standing next to him, guarding him, and his shadow was falling over the detainee. And I remember thinking, looking at this scene, it was dawn light, it was golden, it was like really beautiful light and a moving scene. I remember thinking that for all of the time that I've spent in conflict, like, this is what represents war to me, this faceless idea, the silhouette of the American Marine, the faceless insurgent. Like, this is how men can fight, is when it's depersonalized, is when you're not looking at, you know, Johnny or Muhammad, when you're looking at a symbol. And it was a moment like that when I thought, like, okay, this is an image that I have to make sure I shoot something very powerful of, because this, to me, is what war looks like.
Well, that's interesting. I would assume that you, too, have to become not a person. You're not necessarily a spectator anymore, that you, too, have to become depersonalized to take some of these very, very powerful images or to see some of these moments of history in some of our hottest wars.
I'm not sure that you can ever depersonalize what you're looking at, but you definitely need to separate yourself, your emotions, occasionally from what it is that you're taking pictures of. And I think that the brain usually does that automatically. You know, when it's a really, really extreme situation, you know, like frontline combat, your brain will automatically go into a survival space in which you don't process the emotional ramifications of what it is you're actually looking at. that's not to say that they're not there. You know, you need, I think, in order to for mental health, when you come back from these difficult traumatic situations, you need to go back and re-explore them and find out, you know, how it is you're feeling about them, what you do need to, you know, still process. And that can take years because there's a good reason the brain shuts down and goes into survival mode during these times. So I think that, I mean, yeah, you're right. Like there's, and it sounds almost inhuman, you know, to shut down like that, except I don't think that you could continue working through these places if you were emotionally sort of processing all of the stuff that happened. It's the same as a car crash victim. They'll forget what happened and they have to revisit it and find out what it was and then try to process it and learn to live with it.
And certainly for the soldiers that you have been recording as well and taking pictures of post-traumatic stress syndrome, I know is something that you care a great deal about and have attempted to bring attention to. Let's talk about one of your works published in 2007, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. So you talked earlier about kind of getting into these different spaces, being there for history, and you certainly were able to record that with these shots of the war in Iraq, looking at soldiers in Iraq. I'm curious as to where the title came from and if you maybe could explain what the stories that you're trying to share here are.
Well, the title is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, which stands for WTF. So I actually didn't know what it meant when I was covering the war for the first couple of years. I would hear it on the radio occasionally, and I remember there was actually one situation in which a massive explosion went off, and it started raining like bricks and mortar and all this stuff down all over me and the unit that I was with. And the lieutenant got on the radio and screamed like "Whiskey Tango Foxtrot," and I didn't think anything of it. But I came home and I Googled it. I'm like, oh my God, he had no idea what was going on either. So it turned into, you know, something which, for those of us that were actually on the ground, you know, I think that people in Washington, looking at this from, you know, 1,000 miles above and looking down, it was different. But for those of us that were on the ground, you know, in these little towns around Iraq, it felt like WTF. Like, what's going on here? It's, you know, my job as a photographer is to translate. I think this feeds into your second question. My job as a photographer, these stories, is to translate what foreign policy looks like on a ground level. You know, when somebody in Washington says, do this, how that's executed and what the ramifications of that are can be enormous, except they are too often ignored. It's looked at as policy rather than human. So my job is, you know, telling the stories of, in the case of Iraq, let's say, Iraqi civilians, Iraqi military, American military, and trying to humanize those stories to make decisions that we're making here in Washington, well, here in the United States and in Washington, based around the idea of compassion and empathy and humanity rather than, you know, cold numbers.
There was a lot in this past Iraqi war in regards to embedded reporters, embedded photographers. Did you ever feel that your life was endangered? You were certainly in some very tricky situations.
I don't think that you can fairly go to war and not expect to be put into some pretty dramatic situations. So, yeah, of course, it was remarkably dangerous at times. But that's part of the, you know, part of the package that you're buying into.
Again, this idea of your obligation or your responsibility to share the story. Well, a recent book that you have put together kind of takes the story to the aftermath, looking at the it's called The Bedrooms of the Fallen, and just that name gives me chills. But your concept here was to go to the homes of fallen soldiers across the world, really, looking at U.S., Canadian, and our allies, and seeing what their bedrooms still looked like, the families that lost their soldiers. Where did this idea come from, and what was this experience for you?
Well, after a lot of coverage from Iraq, I started feeling like the public was not responding to the type of work, you know, the type of photographs that I was taking, because basically I was taking the same picture over and over again and expecting people to still care. So I wasn't, in my opinion, I wasn't meeting my responsibility as a photojournalist in engaging my readers. I was filling a space in a newspaper, but I wasn't engaging. So I started looking at what I was missing in my photographs, which was the dead and wounded. That was very, very difficult to photograph in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I started trying to find ways that I might be able to draw attention to those issues back home, where there were less restrictions, where I had more access to a story like that. So I started, I camped out at Arlington National Cemetery, and I photographed families coming to visit their loved ones. I photographed memorials. I photographed funerals. I photographed a lot about post-traumatic stress and suicide. But after a couple of years of this, my wife and I were looking at the New York Times when they publish each 1,000 dead American soldiers and Marines. The New York Times would publish a double page of all of their headshots and their names and where they were from. My wife turned to me and said, "You need to photograph their bedrooms." And, you know, for the next 7 years, until the book recently came out, it's what I've been doing. It's the most moving testament to who these men and women were, who they were in their lives rather than in their deaths. I realized that spending time looking at funerals and memorials in an Arlington National Cemetery, I was looking at their death, and I was looking at what remained, which was the relatives and the friends. The reason they were sad is because they were grieving the absence of their loved one. And in these bedrooms is where we can feel that absence, but we can also feel what their lives were, how rich their lives were, how they expressed themselves. You know, like, I think as adults, we have a whole home, an apartment, a house, in which we can, you know, fill it with things that we love, things that mean something to us. But our kids, and the kids in this book, they're not kids, I know, they're grown-ups, but the soldiers and Marines in this book, they have one room in the house through which they can express themselves. That's the one place in the world that is theirs. So the rooms are really just this beautiful expression of who they were. I mean, there's one room in there, which is Christopher Scherer's room that I love. Chris apparently begged his dad for years, "Could I please put one sticker up on my wall?" And his dad was like, "No, no way, no stickers on the wall, you ruin the paint." Till finally, after 2 years, he said, "Yeah, okay." And then Chris's room just exploded. There's not an inch free on the wall anywhere. It's like Tyra Banks posters, it's shot glasses, it's a wanted poster of Bin Laden, it's the leprechauns maybe do it, it's a U.S. flag hanging from the roof, it's a charcoal rubbing of Christopher Scherer, who died in the Vietnam War, from the memorial. It's every single thing this Chris seemed to have collected and stuck on his wall.
His family kept the room as it was.
His family kept the room exactly as it was. It's still exactly the same as it was then, today. I mean, I saw them on the weekend and Saturday, and they were saying that before he died, he had called home and said, you know, how are things going? And they said, "Well, actually, your dad's been offered a job down south. We're thinking about maybe taking it and moving down there." And he said, that sounds great. But before you go, make sure you take a saw and cut my room out and bring it with you. You know, I mean, his room, there's so many things in it. And the purpose of the book and of this work is that, you know, we learn who they were in their lives, but we find an object in one of these rooms that relates to your life. You know, like maybe you played lacrosse as a child, and you look at Chris's room and you see the Tyra Banks and you see the shot glasses and you see all of this stuff, but then you see, like, the lacrosse sticks, and that's your connection to him. That's how you can start empathizing with his life. You know, through your life, it's like a doorway. And I think that once you find in each of these rooms that doorway, then you can start to really connect with who these people were. And, you know, there's 40 rooms, like you said, from our allies over in Europe, from Canada, and from the United States.
Such a moving tribute, and you say a way to humanize the situation and make us all feel attached to that. Well, always thinking about that responsibility that you feel to share these really, really important stories. Thank you so much for sharing them with us today, and we'll look for your next project soon.
Thanks for having me.